think very much in the spirit of practice what you preach. I confess that I'm completely amazed and delighted that David Spiegelhalter has managed to avoid giving a speech, which I'm sure he's written, and will use his speech to actually be rather rude about the rest of us. So well done, David, and I will not forget this. I thought I might start my talk by moving away from my slightly myopic view of Whitehall and think about risk and thinking a little bit wider. So one of the things that I managed to dredge up was actually the global risk landscape, which came from the World Economic Forum. This is the sort of familiar likelihood against impact that people are well aware of, and we use throughout. I will come back to some of these, but this was about their 2010 concerns, and you'll note very high up as a major concern is the slowing of the Chinese economy, which is an interesting thought, but I suppose if the World Economic Forum, that is probably rather important. And that there are numbers of issues out here, but also things like food price volatility, chronic diseases moving into the more natural world, and further down in here you've got issues of extreme weather and water security. What is interesting, however, is to look at what they've done over the last 5 years or so. And you'll see a degree of constancy and concerns about the Chinese economy. If in fact it drops by 6%, we have a major problem. I think it's arguable that if it goes much above the current rate, we also have a major problem, but that is possibly not a politic answer, and I emphasize many times I'm the chief scientific advisor, not a political or economic commentator. But I think one of the things that is interesting about this is the way in which some of the issues that we have been exploring in various meetings here at the FST are starting to come into this register. What you're seeing, for example, is obviously issues to do with chronic disease. The first concern about food was raised in 2008, slightly sort of following on from what was obvious as a problem of the rising food prices, but actually in 2009, seeing considerable attention being taken with resource-related risk, water, land, and energy. That was 2009. And chronic disease, and interestingly, in 2010, infrastructure. Clearly, the thing that has worried the Economic Forum and has been since 2006 is asset prices and indebtedness, and those things are with us forever. It's intriguing because I think that it shows that throughout there are different issues coming up, some of which will actually are amenable to scientific or engineering analysis, others which are arguably amenable to science, to economic analysis, but many others are coming in at a level that is real concern, global governments being obvious. But what I'm going to talk about today is three examples of largely of areas that I am involved in, have been involved in, or will be involved in. And I want to talk about three areas of risk and pose the problem. How do we move from risk to problems, and what happens when risk becomes reality, and how do we respond? So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. I'm going to focus on three areas. In the civil contingencies area, they're rather familiar and arguably over discussed in these fora, the climate change issue. And finally, something rather new, I'm going to be talking about some of the issues to do with risk in financial markets, which is a forthcoming study that the Foresight team are going. But let's just go back to what government does and look at the national risk. In fact, this is the National Risk Register, not the National Risk Assessment. And look at the sort of things that are actually there. This is the 2010 edition. And clearly, the sort of things that we're worried about are there. We have got the issues of pandemic disease still up there as the highest combination of probability and impact. Attacks on crowded places and attacks on transport in the terrorism arena. Severe weather, which we've already seen some significant problems. And I think one of the things that is interesting about risk analysis is, for example, the severe weather that we were seeing in Russia in terms of a heat wave and the forest fires associated with that heat wave, together with the tragic floods in Pakistan, were actually caused by the identical climate phenomena. Not a thing I'm going to expand on here, but it poses problems for how we deal with risk, and obviously issues of coastal flooding and animal disease. This is the typical, and this is indeed the National Risk Register that is produced by the Cabinet Office every year. And how is it done? Well, Looking out on this, many of the faces I know, they know how this is done, and so telling you how it's done is slightly tedious, but forgive me, just a few of you may not know, but in effect, what one is looking at in terms of the hazard, we're asking about likelihood, historical evidence can come into that, predictable events, weather. That I was quite amused when I saw that. Predictable events, for example, weather forecasts, struck me as being a slightly Irish way of phrasing it, if that's not too racist a remark. Expert advice, again, I see, and that under the characterization of hazard struck me as also rather amusing. But in terms of plausibility, we need to be thinking about it, and David O'Mahon, is going to be, I'm sure, talking about intelligence, about capability, intent, and vulnerability. And of course, we move to that likelihood and the risk into effective impact. The impacts that are typically taken into account are obviously deaths, casualties, a degree of social disruption, economics, and interestingly, psychological, which is the way in which the public reacts to these problems. And I think one of the areas where I think we do need to be pondering a little bit is the way in which we think about what was a reasonable worst case. For example, the reasonable worst case that we were dealing with when we had the swine flu epidemic in 2009 came from a slightly odd combination of what happened in the epidemic in 1918 and what H5N1 might produce. And that came up with a reasonable worst case of something of the order of 650 to 750,000 deaths. A little difficult when that got taken up by much of the press as being a prediction, and we had rather less than that, shall we say, by a couple of orders of magnitude. So this reasonable worst case is something I think bears examination, and we need to be thinking about it because it's part of the process in which we actually which underpins our planning for dealing with risks. Now you'll note that the risk register published for 2010 didn't have anything about volcanoes, and that was probably a bit of a mistake, really. I'll go into this in some detail, but if you actually look at it, there's 30 or so potentially active volcanic systems in Iceland. By and large, historical eruptions are about 25 per 100 years, so once every 4 years would be a historical average. Then a large proportion of them were explosive, and basically what we're talking about is we might expect significant volcanic eruption in Iceland occurring round about every 20 years of something fairly serious. There are periodicities in the volcanic activity in Iceland, periodicities which indicate that by and large the last 50 years or so have been relatively quiescent, if that's the right word for a volcano, and therefore, arguably, with a major increase in air travel, we were arguably really rather lucky for those 50 years. But we need to be thinking about what will happen, because there, as I will say a little later, there are quite a lot of volcanoes in Iceland. Putting this on to the risk matrix seems to me to be a reasonable thing to do. The one that is, of course, completely unpronounceable is the one that we had the problem with in April. I will sort of not even attempt it. I will call it Aya, or that volcano. But next to Aya is Katla, much easier to pronounce, but also larger, bigger, and arguably rather more concerning. And we need to be pondering about what would actually happen if Katla went off. It's something of the order of 30 times the amount of material would come out of Katla than came out of Aya. Laki, which was the one occurring about 200 or 300 years ago, lower probability, but very significant impact. And the recent one down in the bottom right-hand corner, we had grumbling around and worrying us all for the last couple of weeks, is Grimsvötn. And this one, again, under a glacier, again, the lava would melt the glacier. And what was noted by our Icelandic colleagues was a large lake forming. So that was a bit of concern, but it seems to have gone quiescent. And of course, if we think about what I suppose the very low probability but enormous impact events, Krakatoa, and the effect on the planet of Krakatoa going off is up there in the top left-hand corner. But as I said, there really are a lot of volcanoes in Iceland. Now, how would we represent that on a matrix, on the conventional matrix. I've shown where I think some of these individual volcanoes will do. But if we're worried about volcanoes as a whole, how would we do it? I put a large question mark because I wouldn't even dream of suggesting this is that particular ellipse. But what we can say, and I think this is general, is that we are going to have some form of correlation, an inverse correlation between the impact and the likelihood. The little ones are more likely, the very big ones are less likely. So we'll have a slope, something like that. And that really is how a work in progress. We are needing to ponder how we deal with volcanoes, because there are a lot of them. Of course, the true risk only occurs when the volcano goes off and erupts. The ones that are actually in Iceland will erupt and send large showers of dust into the upper atmosphere because they are getting superheated steam from the lava interacting with the glacier. But also, you need, in terms of worrying us, as opposed to the Icelanders or the Icelandic sheep who are grazing the slopes, we get worried when we get a north-northwesterly wind and we have significant disruptions to airspace. I don't want to go into the way in which regulations have interacted today, because I'm really just focusing on risk, but that combination is important. One of the groups that I have introduced to government in the last couple of years is what I've called the Blackett Reviews, where we bring people in from across the academic and industry community to ask questions that we have about general scientific or engineering questions. And at the last Blackett meeting, where we were talking about black swan events, these low probability, high impact events, a bit like Krakatoa, I suppose if you live in Tasmania, where black swans are ubiquitous, black swan events look a little bit odd, but I suppose everything is relative. And one of the interesting presentations that David Bell gave was a new way of, and this is new to me, the old hat people in risk analysis will know this very well, but I was particularly charmed by it. First of all, charmed by the irritation that he had actually reversed the axes, so the impact is on the x-axis and the probability is on the y-axis, which does make it a little bit different, and largely unnecessarily so, I would argue. He's characterised these in terms of a number of different ways, using mythology. And going to the next solution, these classes of management possible risk are really quite interesting. I think I would leave David Omand, who is more the classical scholar than I, to comment on whether the appropriate comments on nomenclature. But Damocles, a high damage, low probability of occurring. Cyclops, high damage, uncertain. Essentially, the Pythia and Pandora, uncertain throughout. And discursive, very Cassandra high. That's the sort of thing you worry about and don't have any way of actually working on. And then you think about the probability of occurrence. And then Medusa, with a low extent of damage and a low probability of occurrence. I probably wouldn't bother too much about Medusa. But interestingly, and again, this is from this analysis, are there alternative strategies for action? Now, that's a new way, at least it was new to me, about thinking about some of the ways which we would deal with risk. And I think this is worthy of debate. I think we need to be thinking about it. And people like David, when he comments on this, will say, well, you know, this is Bennington's ideas here have been thoroughly undermined by the following 17 papers, including five of my own. So, David, I'm just anticipating your intervention at this stage. So that's the thing, that's the sort of ways we actually deal with risk. And I've used volcanoes as an example. And what do we do when it happens? Again, using volcanoes as an example. The major impact, of course, of the volcano was nothing to do with human health or nothing to do with animal health, but was to do with human irritation by having their travel plans significantly interrupted. And the Civil Contingency Committee was called. This was the timing of this was good because it was in the middle of the election campaign, and so PIRDA was in operation, so it was made a little bit complicated. But this is the typical sort of thing that will happen when we get an emergency. There will be the COBRA committee will meet, sometimes chaired by the Prime Minister, sometimes chaired by the appropriate Secretary of State for the department it's in. You pull together a committee. In this case, in the volcanic one, we were able to get groups operating both on the aviation and engineering issues, the meteorology group, clearly important, and the geology and volcanology subgroup, all of whom met together and started to interact. We had inputs from the Met Office, the BGS, the Met Office being part of MOD, BGS being part of Natural Environment Research Council, and inputs from our research council and academic experts. And that's a sort of typical way we would want to do it. It had to be done in a fairly fast time, as many of these things will be doing, and we have used this group to actually explore what sort of risk we might expect from further volcanoes. So that's a typical example. It lasted a relatively short time. This similar SAGE that I convened dealing with the swine flu outbreak lasted about 6 or 7 months. So these will be short and operating sometimes. Sometimes they will be quite extensive. So that's the volcanoes. Let's move again now on to climate change. And as I say, this is a slightly overworn topic, but this is one slide that I think is really really shows it all. This gives you an idea of the change in the UK mean temperature. As you can see, enormous variation, climate being some form of statistical averaging of climate. You can see very clearly that in this trend, as we go through the period up to 2006 or 7, that the occurrence of cold weather becomes significantly less frequent and the occurrence of hot weather becomes more and more frequent. And that's within the UK, but climate change is enormously complex, enormously difficult, and enormously uncertain. This is the sort of map that people have put together. This was put together by the Hadley Centre at the request of the Foreign Office, looking at what a 4-degree world will look like. And I've spoken about this before in this fora. But the 4-degree world was assessed by looking at something like 27 different models and realizations of models, from the most optimistic to the most pessimistic. 4-degree worlds happening in the most pessimistic scenarios by about 2060, the most optimistic by about 2110. The most optimistic would give you a rise in the Arctic of at best 8 degrees and at worst 16 degrees. And these are the sort of things that we'll do. This is terribly familiar to many of you, but I think it's really important. I think it is interesting to say, how can we actually really start to think about what these climate risks? We can look at this and say, isn't it awful? We can look at this and say complete nonsense, but you know, the computer model's going way beyond their ability to assess it. But how are we actually going to take that into account in planning our strategy? And obviously, risk and uncertainty is coming in different ways. This is some work that, I can't read his name. It's Sutton, Rowan Sutton has done, looking at the different sources of uncertainty, some from the internal variability, largely driven by the fluid dynamics of chaotic ensembles, differences to do with scenario uncertainty, what's going to happen in the rest of the world, and the response uncertainties. And together, as you move through, you can see that the internal variability is a very important source of uncertainty at the start, becomes less so, and scenario uncertainties and response uncertainties reach a peak, and then start, and the scenario uncertainty in particular starts to dominate. But question, and I posed the question to my colleagues in the Government Office of Science and said, has there anybody done on the normal risk matrix climate change? And I don't know that they have. Maybe somebody knows that they have. Now, this is pure speculation. If we actually put the risks of climate change on this sort of matrix, whether in fact, in terms of relative likelihood, sea level rise, risk to forests, whether in fact that would convey somewhat more information than the sort of, oh heavens, isn't it awful maps that we actually look at. And that's a question. I don't know the answer to it, and I think it's one that it is interesting, particularly in terms of not so much the debate between sort of skeptics and believers, which is not the way I would choose to characterize it, but asking the questions about the relative likelihood of some of these events and the relative impact of those events as they are in particular regions. And I think that's a framework that I haven't seen before. Forgive me if others have seen it and are bored to death by it, but I haven't seen it, so you'll have the pleasure of telling me it's in the following 16 papers, and I will then have to go away and be extremely humble about it. So in the last few minutes, I'm going to move on to the last portion, and this is something that is rather different. What we have been looking at, and this is a foresight study, is looking at the way in which high-frequency trading, that's trading working on milliseconds, and the proportion of algorithmic trades and high-frequency trades that have actually been occurring. These are figures for the US equity volume, and as you can see, from 2006, it's gone up from about 15% of the volume to well up to over 50% now. And in other markets, it's actually rather greater. Now, you've got algorithmic tradings, and you've got faster and faster trades being executed, and indeed stock exchanges are competing to be a faster, to be able to trade at a faster rate. This shows you the sort of differences in terms of milliseconds for an individual trade for execution. From Singapore, which is the slowest, but if you look on the far right, predictably Singapore has a cunning plan, and the cunning plan is, as you will see, to completely dominate the speed of trading. This is the tendency. Speed of trading to execute trades means that trades are actually coming rather faster, rather cheaper, but of course it means that algorithmic trading and arbitrage around those algorithmic trades becomes more and more attractive. Just recently, the London Stock Exchange introduced its turquoise system. Don't look at the things about it being sabotage. The key thing about this, because that's the only articles we could get, but the turquoise system will actually be twice as fast as any system elsewhere and any stock exchange in the world. Because of the problems they've had with it, there's a glitch, whether in fact it was human or other causes irrelevant for this particular presentation, but it's going to be reintroduced in the new year, and then the LSE will actually have the fastest exchange system for trades in the world by about a factor of two. Now, do we care? Well, I think we do. If we think about an engineering question about a system in which the proportion that is actually operating in terms of algorithmic ways and at higher and higher speed and larger volumes, just in general, anyone who thinks about the engineering problems of stability in networks will know there's a problem. And also, we've got a bit of empirical evidence there's a problem. Many of you will now know this. This is the flash crash, May the 6th, occurred in the New York Stock Exchange. Notice the time scale on the bottom. It's between 2 p.m. and about 2:30 p.m. The entire U.S. market fell by a little under 10%. And that was in about 35 seconds. In that time, trading volume went up. Some stocks were valued at effectively a cent. Other stocks were valued at over $100,000. Give or take, 99% of the whole of the market volume went off in that tiny, tiny interval. There's been big investigations. What was the cause of it? An explanation coming out from the US investigation was that there was a relatively modest trade in the context of US trading of about $4 billion going through with no particular price or timing. That generated all the algorithms essentially tossed trades to and fro until the exchange realized what was happening and cost it. It's a big problem. $70 billion were pulled out of the US equity funds almost immediately after. So we have got to think a little bit about that. So we have a Foresight project just starting, which is looking at the future of computer trading in financial markets, financial stability. How will we, and we'll be posing engineering questions with economists and bankers and traders, but we're posing, I think, what are important engineering questions about the sort of structure, because we do know that markets are going to go faster and faster. The trends in algorithmic trading are likely to continue. How are those trends going to interact with the financial stability? One thing that's not mentioned about the flash crash is that basically there was about 10% was wiped off the FX trading. The equity trades were reversed. There's a way of doing that. The FX trading, a lot of people lost an awful lot of money. So that's the next stage. We've got a Foresight project started on that, probably be announced this week, and we're going to be working up over the next year or so. And I think it's interesting to ask questions in the context of what we've seen about how financial markets are treated in an engineering way. But we're always going to have problems. Let's just look at the latest thing in the terrorism world, the Christmas Day bombing, which didn't work, embedding explosives in underwear, a response to that in terms of sort of shielding with all sorts of problems, and the latest one with the cargo bomb plot with printer cartridges containing it. There are always going to be threats, there are always going to be problems, and there are always therefore going to be risks and the need to address those risks. So because I've been talking Greek initially, I will end with Latin. Cicero said that probability is direct conduct of the wise man. So thank you for your attention.